Hare Krishna, dear friends. Thanks so much for joining us for our Krishna Kills the Demons open heart surgery sessions. We're not talking one heart operation. We're talking of 20. And I know for certain that without your association and support, I most definitely wouldn't be able to face such a challenge. So thank you very much for coming. Okay, so the higher authorities, the hospital authorities have decided that today we won't begin surgery. They felt that it would be more appropriate if we do a little prelim orientation work to help us prepare ourselves for the rigorous surgery schedule that we'll be following for the next few weeks. So the first thing that I want to do is to give you your personal medical files. It's very important that you keep all your reports and any important papers in this. And whenever you come for surgery, please bring it, because we'll be referring to this quite a lot. So what we want to do now to begin our time together is a few reality checks. Are we in the right place? Are we here with the right mood? All these sorts of things. Just to really get a solid grounding of what we're going to be doing. We'll be able to cope with things a lot better if we've done this. Okay, so take the first file of sheets out of your medical file. And this is checklist one, a reality check. Am I a devotee or a demon? This is the first thing we have to have a look at. Do I have a demon problem? If the heart's not diseased, why should I operate? So first we have to convince ourselves that yes, this is what I need. I really do need this. Okay, so let's have a look at this. Who is a demon? One who does not accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead is certainly a demon. Similarly, anyone who does not accept Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as Krishna, the same Supreme Lord, is also to be considered a demon. This is from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi 8.9. So what does it mean to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead? It means to accept that he is the Supreme Doer, the Supreme Controller, and the Supreme Enjoyer. No one is equal to him, nor greater than him. We read from Bhagavad Gita, under the spell of illusion, living entities are trying to be lords of all they survey, but actually they are dominated by the material energy of the Lord. The Lord is the master of material nature, and the conditioned souls are under the stringent rules of material nature. Unless one understands these bare facts, it is not possible to achieve peace in this world, either individually or collectively. This is the sense of Krishna consciousness. This is from Prabhupada's pulpit, the 529. So do I have this sense of Krishna consciousness? Let's check our heart's honest response to what we're about to read. Devotees should always be happy with the dealings of their master, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A devotee may be put into difficulty or opulence, but he should accept both as gifts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and jubilantly engage in the service of the Lord in all circumstances. What's your heart's response to that?
That's
easy when we're reading it. What happens when we try to practice it? This is always the question.
Can I ask something? If somebody doesn't want opulence, then there's no need to accept. No, I mean, for example, renounce it, they don't.
We'll talk a little bit about that in one of the checklists. See if I answer your question in the next one, in the third one. One should not be unhappy when reverses come upon him by the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A devotee should always be happy to receive the fortune awarded him by the Supreme Lord, which seems pleasant or unpleasant according to one's judgment. A devotee understands that the happiness and distress he undergoes due to performing bhakti and committing aparads are special mercy from the Lord. It is like the father who sometimes makes his child drink milk and sometimes makes him drink bitter neem juice. Sometimes the father embraces and kisses his son, and other times he beats him. The devotee accepts whatever happens to him as the arrangement of the Lord acting for his benefit. The devotee thinks, "The Lord certainly knows what is best for me, even if I don't know. Karma and time have no effect on the devotee, so this is Krishna's personal arrangement for me. Out of his mercy, Krishna sometimes gives me happiness and sometimes gives me distress, considering how to engage me in his service." So we should have an honest look at our hearts. Is this our level of relationship with Krishna? Or do we sometimes say, "Why me? I do so much service, why me?" Maybe we think like that sometimes. I'd like to share with you something that Jnanivas Prabhu said to me that made a very deep impact on me. He is a very, very special devotee, Hepajari at Mayapur. And I was living in Mayapur for 18 years, and I saw him in many difficult circumstances, and I saw that he was always very equipoised and always peaceful, never vindictive. And I asked him once, "How is it that you can maintain your equilibrium in all circumstances?" And his response was spontaneous and immediate. He said, "I just understand that whatever circumstance I'm in, that's the best possible circumstance I could be in for progressing in Krishna consciousness." Wow. Very profound statement. That whatever circumstance I'm in, that arrangement Krishna has made for my advancement, perhaps I need the neem. Perhaps there are things that the sweet words are not working. I don't understand. I'm not responding. I'm not changing. Maybe we need the neem. So it's very important to realize, okay, I do have some demoniac tendency, some sense of independence, some sense of I want it my way. So first one. Second one that we have to look at: in my heart of hearts, do I really want Braj Bhakti? Do I really want to follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan? And do I have a clear idea of what that means? We're going to do heart surgery so that we attain Braj Bhakti. But do we know what it is? Do we really want it? An important point. Now, in this handout, this check, reality check, I haven't given conclusive definitions. I've been more interested in definitions that will prompt us to think. So let's have a look at the first one. What does the word dham mean? We're going to read from Prabhupada's Krishna book. "The appearance of the form of Krishna anywhere, and specifically within the heart, is called dham. Dham refers not only to Krishna's form, but also to his name, qualities, and his paraphernalia. Everything becomes manifest simultaneously." So what we're actually doing by performing this surgery is that we're saying to Krishna, "Please make my heart your dham. Please make your heart my dham." At the moment, so many demons are there, so much rubbish is there, but this is what we want. We also understand from this definition by Prabhupada that the dham is not just the place. We're talking about Krishna's place. "Oh, I'm in Vrindavan." How Krishna conscious are we? That will determine whether we're in Vrindavan. Let's have a look at the next one. It's a very amazing statement made by Prabhupada in his additional notes to the first chapter of the 10th canto of Bhagavatam. What does it mean to live in Vrindavan? When a self-realized soul acts in his transcendental position, his situation is called Mathura. In other words, when one acts in the process of bhakti yoga, he may live anywhere, but actually he lives in Mathura, Vrindavan. Devotion to Krishna, the son of Nanda Maharaj, is the essence of all knowledge. And whatever such knowledge is manifested, wherever such knowledge is manifested, is called Mathura. Also, when one establishes bhakti yoga, excluding all other methods, one's situation is called Mathura. Very much challenges our present understanding of what it means to live in Vrindavan. I've got an apartment here. I've got service here. I'm physically here. But the point is that we're not, when we're talking about living in Vrindavan, being here externally, being here in the physical plane is very, very important in the sense that it's a place for the eternal pastimes. The dham is very different. It's very different to live in the dham than to live outside of the dham. Outside of the dham, we can control the material energy. We're superior to the material energy. But in the dham, especially in this dham, it's under the jurisdiction of Srimati Radharani, Ladini Shakti, the Lord. We can't control her. So it is a very, very, very wonderful thing to be able to live here physically, but it's not enough. If we have the good fortune to live here physically, we should understand that it's the mercy of our Gurudev, of Prabhupada and of Srimati Radharani, but we should take full advantage of it and really live here. If you want to understand the nature of someone who really lives here, perhaps you may like to hear sometimes from Radha Govinda Maharaj.
He speaks Hindi.
There are people translating now. The greed is here, there's greed.
They do. I didn't know.
The greed is grown.
Oh, thank you for telling me.
Okay, so what does it mean to be a bridge basi? This is a very important point. I want to follow in the footsteps of the bridge basi. I want Braj Bhakti. Let's get real. Am I prepared to make the changes in my consciousness, in my persona? Do I really want to follow in the footsteps of the bridge basi? Let's read what Prabhupada has to say. Actually, we're reading from the first thing that we'll read from is from Sanatana Goswami's Brihad Bhagavatamrita. The Brijvasis use their egos to identify themselves as servants of Krishna, their intelligence to make up their minds to act always for his satisfaction, their eyes to see him, their tongues to chant, and their ears to hear his glories. From Krishna Book, the cowherds of Vrindavan had their minds fixed on Krishna. That is a symptom of perfect knowledge. And because their minds were always engaged in Krishna, they were automatically freed from all material activities. This stage of life is called Yukta Vairagya, as enunciated by Srila Rupa Goswami. Knowledge and renunciation, therefore, do not mean dry speculation and renunciation of activities. Rather, one must start speaking and acting only in relationship to Krishna. The difference between the pure devotees of Vrindavan and devotees in other places is that the residents of Vrindavan have no other desire but to be associated with Krishna. Krishna, being very kind to his devotees, fulfills their desire because they always want Krishna's association. The Lord is always prepared to give it to them. The devotees of Vrindavan are also spontaneous lovers. They are not required to strictly follow regular principles because they are already naturally developed in transcendental love for Krishna. Regulative principles are required for persons who have not achieved such a position of spontaneous love. Brahma is also a devotee of the Lord, but he is an ordinary devotee subject to following regulative principles. He prays to Krishna, to give him the chance to take birth in Vrindavan so that he might be elevated to the platform of spontaneous love. The super-excellent quality of the service rendered by the residents of Vrindavan is due to their spontaneously engaging all natural instincts in your loving service, in Krishna's loving service, not in sense gratification. Isn't it our tendency to spontaneously engage all our natural sense instincts in sense gratification? But the residents from Vrindavan, they spontaneously engage all natural instincts in Krishna's loving service. It is said that attachment for material objects and home is due to an illusion which makes the living entity conditioned in the material world. But this is only the case for persons who are not Krishna conscious. In the case of the residents of Vrindavan, such abstractions as attachment to hearth and home are non-existent, because their attachment has been directed unto you, and their homes have been converted into temples by your constant presence there. And because they have forgotten everything for your sake, there is no impediment. For a Krishna-conscious person, there is no such thing as impediments due to attachment for hearth and home, nor is there illusion. In Vrindavan, there is no distinction between material and spiritual, because everything is dedicated to your loving service. If cruel Krishna can pass his time without us, why can't we pass our time without Krishna? Of course, Krishna is passing his days without us very happily, but we cannot pass our days happily without him. This last one is a really important one. We're separated from Krishna. Are we feeling separation? We have some ways to go. So this is just a couple of checklists that we wanted to have a look at. One more. It's also important. Most often, when challenges or problems come our way, our response is, I'll figure it out. I'll work it out. So this is what we're doing. We're swinging between these two constantly, gyan and kam, gyan and kam. We're swinging like this. Now what Krishna and his associates are saying is different. They're saying, just hear and chant it out. He's not saying, try and figure it out. He's not saying, try and work it out. He's saying, just hear and chant it out. So the next checklist, the reality check is, am I prepared to do things Krishna's way? Do I have faith that he is the best surgeon and he knows what he's doing? Now, I want to take a little diversionary step here. I think it's an important one. Because if we really want to wholeheartedly say, yes, I want to do it Krishna's way, we have to be very clear about our identity. Very, very clear. So I want to have a little, before we do the third reality check, just have a look at this. It's a very interesting and simple and short analysis of what's happening in our lives at present. Now if my primary identity tag is I'm an attractive, successful actress, what's going to be my, if that's my primary identity tag, if I've got a choice, and am I going to read Krishna book, or am I going to read up on diets to keep my shape and form?
Shape and form.
We're going to keep our shape and form. Why? Because of our primary identity tag. If I'm a businessman, that's my primary identity tag. If I've given a choice between Krishna book and Financial Times, what am I going to read?
Financial Times.
Right. So it's not that business as a service is bad. It's not that being an actress as a service is bad. It's a matter of how we identify. For example, Jagat Srini, wonderful devotee, Prabhupada's disciple, when she met Prabhupada, she was a very successful actress. She was actually in Australia filming from memory with Mick Jagger. And even while she was there during that service, when she was asked to come and do service, she said, "I'm interested." They asked her to come and do service. She had a lot of support in terms of, you know, finance and so many things, fame. They asked her to wash the pot. She did. Very interesting. We look at Amrish Ford. You know, obviously his tag is not very wealthy businessman. Otherwise, why is he spending all his wealth on building the Mayapur temple? So you get my point. Mm-hmm. Now, we want to have a quick look at how this misidentification really makes life very tough for us. Misidentification is actually Maya Devi's subtlest and deadliest trap, because our sense of identity, it shapes our desiring. It shapes not only our desiring, but from the desiring will become our discriminating, our setting of priorities. From that will come our thinking and planning. From that will come our feeling. From that will come our willing, our acting, and all of this will shape our destination. Not to mention that how we identify will affect the modes, or govern pretty much, the modes that govern us. And the modes that govern us will govern our faith. This is explained in the 17th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. That our faith is actually determined by the modes that govern us. So this is just to give us some idea that if we really want to do it Krishna's way, we may be doing so many services. We may be raising kids for Krishna. We may be a student, you know, studying, so many things. But the bottom line is that we have to keep the tag, the identity tag, very clear in our minds and hearts. And the safest one, in my humble experience, is that I'm a fallen servant of Krishna, sincerely and seriously seeking reinstatement in his service. If we have that identity tag, anything Krishna says, anything Krishna's associates say, I want to know about it. I want to do it. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's just the way it works. Okay, so now we're ready to go on to our third and last reality check. Have a look in your personal files. You'll find a heading, Got a Problem. Now, I've done quite a bit of research on hearing and chanting about Krishna as the only permanent solution, because we have a tendency to always have something better to do. Again, it's the influence of Jnana Kam. I've got something better to do. So we'll read a couple of them now and see what your heart's response to them, whether you can relate to them or not. But I want you to, when you have a bit of time or you feel a bit challenged about whether you're spending your time well by reading about Krishna during Kartik, after all, we're out to get the mercy. Should do something to get the mercy. So, you know, then look at this and just get a perspective of what, you know, what's real and what's not real. Let's have a look at page 2, top of the page. Remembering that what we're looking at is, am I prepared to do things Krishna's way? Do I believe this statement? Best way to check whether we believe it is if we're living it. How much do we read in a day? This is from Madhya 22.107. Pure love for Krishna is eternally established in the hearts of the living entities. It is not something to be gained from another source. When the heart is purified by hearing and chanting, this love naturally awakens. Simple for the simple. Let's have a look at page 3, second one down. One should always keep himself near you by the process of hearing and chanting your transcendental glories. Simply by being attached to hearing and chanting your glories, one can attain the highest perfectional stage of entering into your kingdom. If a person therefore always keeps in touch with you by hearing and chanting your glories and offers the results of his work for your satisfaction only, he very easily and happily attains entrance into your supreme abode. You are realizable by persons who have cleansed their hearts of all contamination. This cleansing of the heart is made possible by chanting and hearing the glories of your Lordship. Next page, page 4. Bottom quote from Krishna book. Great sages, please understand that the transcendental pastimes of Lord Krishna are all eternal. They are not ordinary narrations of historical incidents. Such narrations are identical with the Supreme Personality of Godhead Himself. Anyone, therefore, who hears such narrations of the Lord's pastimes is immediately freed from the contamination of material existence. Next page, last quote, and the last one that we'll read for today. By hearing the pastimes of the Lord of Lord Krishna, one is sure to get elevation and be transferred back home, back to Godhead. Regardless of what one is, if one wants, so this is an important point, regardless of what one is, regardless of what one is, if one wants the association of Lord Krishna and the transcendental kingdom of God for eternity, in blissful existence, one must hear about the pastimes of Lord Krishna and chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The more we study the pastimes of the Lord, the more we become attached to Him. This very attachment to Krishna makes one eligible to be transferred to His abode, Golok Vrindavan. So there's some pretty heavy ammunition here to help keep us on track if the festive spirit of Kartik carries us away at any time. Okay. So these are just some little reality checks. They're private, they're personal, but by now it should be very, very clear whether we really want to go ahead with the surgery. Yeah?
Surgery.
It's obviously in our best interest to be honest with ourselves. Okay, so think about that, and you have time. We won't be doing any surgery today. You can think about it and let us know at the hospital. Okay, so let's move on and take a brief look at the nature of the anattas or the obstacles that we'll be dealing with. I'm going to read a little bit from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Chaitanya Shikshamrita. Here he gives an introduction, which is very informative. Krishna's activities are of two types, nitya, eternal and daily, and naimittika, occasional. In Golok, the Astakaliya Leela unfolds. In the earthly pastimes, occasional pastimes are enjoined within the Astakaliya Leela. Krishna going from and returning to Braj and his killing of the demons are occasional pastimes. These occasional pastimes of Krishna are unavoidable for the devotees still living in the material world. They are present in Golok in an indirect way, but are present fully only within the material world. Furthermore, the occasional pastimes, which are unfavorable to unbroken meditation upon the daily eightfold pastimes, have a symbolic significance for the instruction of aspiring devotees. By remembering these pastimes, the devotees aspire to destroy their own demoniac mentalities and tendencies. So these naimittika or occasional pastimes are a very special gift from Krishna to help we struggling sadhakas who really do want to love him, to actually get to that point. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he tells us that each of the demons killed in Braj, they represent a major anatta, or obstacle, to attaining spontaneous love for Krishna, following in the footsteps of the residents of Braj. It's a good idea to remember that the anattas that we'll be dealing with are not those discussed by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in Madhyuka Damani. He's concerned with anattas that challenge the health of our daily spiritual practices, our bhajana kriya. So he's dealing with that aspect. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's concerned specifically with anattas that are antithetical, completely opposed to developing spontaneous braja bhakti. Mm. So both acharyas are dealing with anatta nivritti, but the anattas are very different in nature. So this is a very important point to remember.
What is Bhaktivinoda Thakur?
Yeah. He's looking at the anattas that obstruct braja bhakti.
And they are different from the ones which obstruct bhakti.
Yes. That'll become very apparent when we look at his analysis of the different demons.
And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's? What are those
anattas? We won't get into that now because we need to do a whole session on it.
Okay.
Maybe we could do that sometime. But he's specifically looking at four groups of anattas which have breakdowns within them. And they're dealing with our daily practice.
With the daily practice.
With our daily practice, yeah. So what I'd like to do now is to share with you the format that we'll be following for all of the open heart surgeries that we do. The reason I want to do that is because we tend to think of the mind as quite a troublesome monster. And quite often it is. But it's important to remember when we're trying to make paradigm shifts or we're going to do something pretty radical, to remember that the mind actually generates from goodness. So if we deal with it in goodness, then things will be a lot easier. So what do we mean by dealing with it in goodness? It means that we're going to inform the mind in advance. We're going to do it in a gentle way. We're going to be very regulated in the way we deal with things. We're going to be very systematic. There's going to be a clear progression. So when you when you're giving the mind some pre-warning of what's happening and telling them it's going to be okay, it's all under control, best offers, all that, then it's a lot easier to do. There's nothing worse than being in the middle of a root canal treatment and deciding that perhaps I made the wrong decision with this dentist. Maybe I chose the wrong dentist. You know, so we want to actually go through things very, very carefully and just see what's what and be very sure. The mind has to be convinced that we're doing the right thing. Then we'll be a cooperator. We won't be obstructive to our own good fortune. Okay, step one. We'll be calling in the most competent and caring heart surgeons available. Step one. Sounds pretty impressive. What do we mean by that? It means we'll be praying to Srila Prabhupada and our acharyas for their support in what we're doing. Step two. We'll ensure that our head theatre nurse, who is expert in dealing with very serious cases, is always present. What's that mean? We're going to sing the Nrisimhadev prayers. Now the mind may say, why are you going to sing the Nrisimhadev prayers? Avatari Krishna, the source of all avatars, is going to kill the demons, either him or his big brother. So why are you calling in the Nrisimhadev?
Because he destroys the matters.
Very good point, but we're talking about anattas that are not destroyed by him. We're talking about anattas that are destroyed by Krishna and Balaram. And our personal
name. He removes the obstacles.
Uh-huh, good point. I tell you my reasoning. My reasoning is that my heart is still framed and it's going to be quite an effort to get it open, to perform the open heart surgery. So Krishna, you know, this Nrisimhadev, he has extremely sharp nails. And he will be able to prise it open and hold it open so Krishna can do his work.
So Prabhupada said in the introduction of the Krishna book, now that actually when Krishna appears, Vishnu, all the avatars appear
fact.
With him.
Okay.
And that it's actually not Swayam Bhagavan Krishna who is killing the demons.
That's a fact. That's a good point. But what I'm trying to point out is that we're not talking about all the avatars being within Krishna. We're talking about bringing in Nrisingadev as a support, because it's also said that the avatars are very attracted to Krishna. And if they get any chance to do some service, I'm sure they'd be very happy. So I'm thinking that, you know, if he's there as a nurse, Krishna will, you know, in whatever form he's going to be doing the killing. But, and there's different shaktis that are doing it. We're not going to get those details now. But Nrisingadev, bring him in. So we'll sing Nrisingadev prayers. Step 3. Before the operation begins, we'll explain the particular problem that we'll be operating on. And we'll be answering any questions of clarification. So that you're very, very peaceful. You know what's happening. You know we know what we're talking about. And life will be okay. And what does this mean? It means that we'll read and explain Bhaktivinoda Thakur's analysis of each anatta and answer any questions about that. Step 4. Then, and only then, we'll begin the open heart surgery. You see? We're preparing you very nicely. And you can rest assured that only our best surgeons will perform the surgery.
Hare Bol.
Only the best. Not some quack. Only the best. So what does this mean? It means that we'll be sharing different presentations of each demon killed by, and we'll be starting with Srila Prabhupada's presentation, and we'll be looking at different acharyas and other Gaudiya Vaishnavas, what they have to say about this. The operation will be very much about hearing.
I have one question.
Yeah, sure.
Since we are different persons, it uh-huh. may be that different anartas are more prominent for different people. So
that's why we're going to do some backup work, post-operation work, where you'll be doing that basically in your home circumstance. Mm. We all have these demons there in the heart, but what you're saying is true, that somewhere it may be more prominent than others. So we're going to give you step 5, actually, is about this. Once the operation has been successfully completed, we'll give some preventative medicine to help safeguard you against further infection or complication. Now, what I mean by that is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is advising, and that is that we will pray to Krishna that this demon is gone, and having prayed to him, we will chant Hare Krishna. We'll do that in union. I just let the guy know that he's not welcome and Krishna's there to keep him out. Mm. Step 6, this will be homework. We'll give you some follow-up self-care advice that you can do in the comfort of your own home regularly. This is very interesting. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says here, in terms of the advice for this, you'll have this as a handout next session, so don't worry about taking a lot of notes. But he says, a serious chanter of Harinam should first petition Sri Krishna for the strength to overcome all these unfavorable tendencies, and should pray like this on a daily basis. By doing this regularly and sincerely, by Krishna's mercy, the devotee's heart will eventually become purified. That is, if the devotee humbly prays in this way to Krishna to remove all the obstacles in the heart that are presented by the demons that Krishna personally killed, Krishna will certainly do so. So we're going to be giving you this little exercise to be doing in your own time. But we'll also give you something else, which this is like whenever we're talking about linking up. Whenever we're talking about yoga, we're talking yam and niyam. So this is, we're looking at the negative, we're trying to get rid of something. But we also need the positive. So I'll also be giving you some prayers from Bhaktivinoda Thakur to help build the devotional mood within our hearts, so that the demons are just not attracted to come back. It's not such an interesting place for them anymore. Sandra? Okay. Now I want to have a look at the most appropriate mood for the surgery. When we think of surgery, we're getting this a lot from Premanju. She's not too inspired about the word surgery. So it's understandable given the, you know. Anyway, but what we want to look at is this is a special kind of surgery. It's a special kind of mood that's required. When we're in difficulty or pain, we may tend towards making hard work out of the circumstance. You know, we really make life very difficult for ourselves. Or we close our eyes and we just pretend it doesn't exist. We have these tendencies. But it's best if we become a conscious cooperator. A conscious cooperator that's peaceful, happy, and confident of the results. And in a nutshell, that means we need to put our minds on the back burner and use our ears to attentively absorb our hearts in relishing, hearing, and chanting about Krishna. Does that sound okay?
That sounds great.
Okay. This kind of surgery is a little different. So I'd like to share a first-class mood sample with you, so that you get a very clear picture of what we're talking about. Well, have a look in your personal files, and you'll find that there's a heading, When Krishna Kills Demons is Joyful. We're looking at Prabhupada in Los Angeles in May 1972. He's in his garden. This is a wonderful insight into Prabhupada's nature is given by Śrīla Kīrtipada in his What's the Difficulty. I went to New Dwarka for about 1 week with Kirtananda Maharaj to receive Brahman initiation. Every evening at dusk, Śrīla Prabhupada went to his garden to hear Krishna book. A few fortunate disciples were able to join him. By Krishna's grace, I was asked to read. I spent each day in anticipation of this blissful activity. Seated on his asana, under the arch of a vine-covered trellis, Srila Prabhupada usually kept his hand in his bead bag. Sometimes we heard him softly chant the Maha Mantra. He carefully listened to Krishna book and sometimes smiled as he heard the delightful activities of Krishna and his brother Balaram. One evening, as I read the story Deliverance of Dravida Gorilla, Srila Prabhupada smiled broadly while hearing the mischievous nature of Dravida. He chuckled when I read the passage. Often he would go to the hermitages of great saintly persons and sages and cause a huge disturbance by smashing their beautiful gardens and orchards. I sensed the story was going to get better, and it did. Not only did he create disturbances in that way, I continued, but sometimes he would pass urine and stool on their sacred sacrificial arena. Srila Prabhupada laughed so hard, I stopped reading for a moment. Seeing his reaction, we all experienced incredible bliss. He ecstatically slapped his leg. He liked hearing about Krishna and Balaram killing the demons. This is the mood. It's going to be a joyful thing. The surgery is not going to be a painful affair. We have to remember that Krishna's killing of the demons is very incidental. I'll give you an example from Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura's commentary on the Trinavata Lila. We all know that Krishna strangled Trinavata up in the air and the demon died. So when we think of Krishna strangling, we think he's putting his full force into the affair. No, he's really getting into it. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he explains that Krishna was in the mood of a small child who was very fearful. He was frightened. And he was holding on to his very life. He was holding on to that neck as his very life. Because, that, you know, there's 800,000 miles, the acharyas tell us, between him and the ground. He's a baby. He's a small child. So he's frightened. He's wanting to experience this mood, this emotion. So he's frightened. He's holding on for his very life. And, of course, side effect of that, Trinavata died. So, you know, this is, we have to be aware that this demon business is just, you know, it's just kicking his foot, you know, he's not doing anything spectacular. His main thing is the loving exchanges between the devotees. And our absorption in that is what will actually get everything else out of the heart. So we should remember that it's a joyful thing.
I read in Gopal Temple when Ugrasen comes to see Krishna after Kamsa died.
Uh-huh.
And then Krishna says, "But I don't want the kingdom. I didn't even want to kill Kamsa." He said, "I didn't plan to kill any demons. They just came and attacked me, so they died." Brought us here, and then he wanted to attack Nanda Maharaj, so he had to kill him. But he was forced. He was not.
It wasn't his business to do that. No, he's a cow herder. Interesting point. Okay, so now I want to move on to the second section of today's session. Usually, we like to know the root cause of our health problems. If we know the root cause, it makes it a lot easier to effectively deal with the problem and to eventually rid ourselves of the disease. So in this light, it's worth noting that the majority of the demons who viciously entered Vrindavan were ordered by Kamsa to do so. They didn't come of their own volition. They were ordered by Kamsa. Kamsa was very much the nasty villain behind the scenes. So I thought before we start killing the demons, we start all this heart surgery, it would be very interesting to have a look at this Kamsa fellow. Get some idea of what's behind the scenes. This person who's sending all these demons. So who was this Kamsa? Was he just an ambitious, small-time king with a vengeance against Krishna and his relatives? Who was this Kamsa? I want to explore this in two ways. Kamsa as a person and Kamsa as a principle. We'll look at it in two ways. Okay, so let's have a look at Kamsa as a person first. From the 10th canto, it's chapter 146, we get an understanding of his nature in a nutshell. Sukadeva Goswami tells us that Kamsa was fiercely cruel and was actually a follower of the Rakshasas. Therefore, he could be neither pacified nor terrified by the good instructions given by Vasudeva. He did not care about the results of sinful activities, either in this life or in the next. Now, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on this verse, he mentions that when Sukadeva is saying that Kamsa was a follower of the Rakshasas, those Rakshasas were Purusha Adan. They were meat eaters. They were meat eaters. So you can understand that if Kamsa is in the association of meat eaters, human meat, humans, they're eating humans, they're man-eaters. So you can imagine where's going to be the compassion. There's going to be no sensitivity. There's going to be a vicious harshness. So this gives us a real nutshell idea that, you know, the guy's not terribly pleasant. Now, what was his mindset? This I'd like to read from the advent of Lord Krishna, from Prabhupada's Krishna book. Krishna was made aware of his previous birth by the grace of Narad. He learnt that in his previous birth he had been a demon of the name Kalanemi, and that he had been killed by Vishnu. Having now taken his birth in the Bhoja family, he decided to become the deadly enemy of the Yadu dynasty. Krishna was going to take birth in that family, and Kamsa was very much afraid that he would be killed by Krishna, just as he'd been killed in his last birth. He first of all imprisoned his father Ugrasen, because he was a chief king among the Jarabhoja and Andhaka dynasties. And he also occupied the kingdom of Surasen, Vasudeva's father. He declared himself the king of all such places. So he's very aggressive and very territorial, very strong controllership problem. So this is his mindset, very, very, not such a pleasant fellow. Now his birth helps give an understanding of this. Usually we understand that he was born of Ugrasen. We say his father was Ugrasen. But the Padma Puran tells us something very interesting about this. That his real father was Gobila, a demon who was expert at speaking on religiosity and Dharma from Shastra. However, he wasn't so good at practicing what he preached. So expert on speaking on it, but couldn't practice it. So his name was Gobila. Now, the interesting thing is that Ugrasen's wife, Padmavati, very chaste, wonderful devotee. This Gobila, he became attracted to her.
What was her name?
Padmavati.
Padmavati.
Yeah, and she wasn't interested. She was dedicated to her husband. So what did he do? He took the form of Ugrasen. Demons can do that, they can change forms. So he took the form of Ugrasen, and of course she thought she was associating with her husband. But it was Gobila. And Kamsa was born of that union. So this Gobila is someone who's only paying lip service to Dharma. He's got no real interest in it. So this is a very interesting little insight into, you know, what he was about and why he was like that. Prabhupada gives us even more amazing information and insight into his behavior as Kamsa in his notes from the 10.1, his additional notes from Bhagavatam 10.1. He says something very interesting about Kalanemi in relation to his sons. I read what he says. Formerly, an asura called Kalanemi had six sons named Hamsa, Subhakrama, Krata, Damana, Ripuamarda, and Krodahanta. They were known as the Sadgavas or Six Gavas, and they were all equally powerful and expert in military affairs. These Sadgavas gave up the association of Hiranyakashipu, their grandfather. That means Kalanemi was the son of Hiranyakashipu. They gave up the association of their grandfather and underwent great austerities to satisfy Lord Brahma, who, upon being satisfied, agreed to give them whatever benediction they might desire. When asked by Lord Brahma to state what they wanted, the Sadgavas replied, "Dear Lord Brahma, if you want to give us a benediction, give us the blessing that we will not be killed by any demigod, Maharoga, Yaksha, Gandharvapati, Siddha, Charana, or human being, nor by great sages who are perfect in their penances and austerities." Brahma understood their purpose and fulfilled their desire. But when Hiranyakashipu came to know of these events, he was very angry at his grandsons, You have given up my association and gone to worship Lord Brahma, he said, and therefore I have no longer any affection for you. You have tried to save yourself from the hands of the demigods, but I curse you in this way. Your father will take birth as Kamsa and kill all of you, because you will take birth of the sons of Devaki. Every curse. Because of this curse, the grandsons of Hiranyakashipu had to take birth from the womb of Devaki and be cured by Kamsa, although in previous life he was their father. This description is mentioned in the Haribangsa Vishnupava, second chapter. So that gives a very interesting perspective on, you know, this amazingly complex person we know as Kamsa. I want to just read something from Krishna book about his preoccupation and destination. This is in the killing of Kamsa. Prabhupada says, from the day Kamsa had heard he would be killed by the eighth son of Devaki, he was always thinking of Krishna with his wheel in hand. And because he was very much afraid of his death, he was thinking of Krishna in that form 24 hours a day without stopping, even while eating, while walking, and while breathing. And naturally, he got the blessing of liberation. Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur explains, but that by this constant meditation on Krishna, it eradicated all his offenses. Not just his sinful reaction, but all of his offenses. So then Prabhupada continues, according to the opinion of authorities, Kamsa attains Sarupya Mukti after death. That is to say, he attained the same form as Narayan, Vishnu. On the Vaikuntha planets, all the inhabitants have the same bodily features as Narayan. After his death, Kamsa attained liberation and was promoted to Vaikuntha Loka. Pretty amazing. Such a nasty fellow, but such a high destination. And Prabhupada goes on to say that, you know, meditation on Krishna and whatever, whether it's in fear, envy, hatred, whatever it is, it can't bring a bad result. I want to have a look at Kamsa as a principle now. This insight is given very much by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. In his Patana article, he tells us that Kamsa represents the typical aggressive empiricist. So empiricist means someone who doesn't believe anything he can't see or physically experience. It's not a matter of denying it, it just doesn't enter their gamut. They don't have any room in their consciousness for anything but what they can see and experience around them. And he's aggressive. He's an aggressive empiricist. That means he's not happy to be an empiricist himself. You've got to be one too. And from the nature we saw in him as a person, it's very violent, persuasive. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati tells us that he has three main avenues for suppressing bhakti, suppressing transcendence, suppressing any interest in the absolute personality of Godhead. And those three main avenues are material institutionalized religion, pseudo preachers and teachers.
Material institutionalized?
What's that?
I'm just trying to write down this.
Okay, no problem. If I got too fast, just tell me.
Material institutionalized.
So the three main avenues are material institutionalized religion. First one.
Material what?
Institutionalized.
Religion.
Yeah. Second one, pseudo preachers and teachers. Bogus.
Shudra.
Pseudo. Pseudo, not real. Yeah, bogus preachers and teachers. And the third one is what is called lexicographers. These are people who translate just by dictionary. They're dictionary translators. They don't have any realization. They don't have any faith in a parampara or acharyas. Everything is by dictionary. So this is the third.
How they are called?
Oh, don't worry about the fancy word. I can tell you after class if you're really interested. Just put dictionary translators.
No faith in acharyas.
Can we ask some questions on this?
Wait a sec. You're most welcome, but just let me add a little point here that Bhaktivinoda Thakur also tells us something interesting in this regard. Because we're talking pseudo-religion, we're talking Kaitava religion and its preachers. And it's interesting that Kamsa's, two of his wives, two of his queens, were given by Jarasandha in marriage to Kamsa. One was called Asti and one was called Prapti. Now it's interesting because Asti means complacency, take it easy. Let Jesus save me from my sins. Huh? Complacency, take it easy. No need to make a big endeavor. And Prapti, mundane gain. We're practicing religion for material profit. Kaitava. So it's interesting that, you know, his energies, the wife is usually seen as the energy of the husband, so two of his primary energies were these Asti and Prapti.
Complacency and mundane gain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now in his Bhakti, his Vatsasura article, Bhaktisiddhanta tells us something else. He tells us that Kamsa is the king of atheists. He's the king of atheists. Now empiricism and atheism, they go hand in hand. This is one of the reasons that Prabhupada is so against the scientists. Because it's based on empiricism. So these two things go hand in hand. Okay, any questions now? Do you have a question for me?
Yes, I have a question about a material institutionalized religion.
Uh-huh.
Trying to understand this a little better.
Mm-hmm. Can we save that until we discuss Patana?
Sure.
Because there what we'll do, we'll look at that in depth. And we'll be getting a lot of our insights from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's article. And I'll be reading key sentences to you about that.
My question was: does this refer only to material religions, or it can be in some subtle form also affecting our
definitely.
Society, like you know,
definitely.
These subtle obstacles
yeah,
in
yeah.
Punachandra?
Yeah, definitely, it can affect the spiritual institution.
Mm-hmm.
There are some amazing statements by Bhaktisiddhanta that I'll share with you about that. And also many of the demons, when we look at them, we can understand that they're reigning en masse. It's not that it's my individual problem. It may be a collective problem also that is actually badly hindering
mm-hmm.
Prabhupada's preaching method. So we will have a look at it from that angle when we discuss Patana.
What does it mean these three venues are?
Yeah, made? These are the avenues that he uses. Like these are the like his puffets. This is how he influences through these mediums.
For his activities.
Yeah.
But his activities were very gross, no? I mean, the...
But remember we're talking Kamsa as a principle now.
This is amazing.
We're talking Kamsa as a principle. So what we're looking at is the typical aggressive empiricists. Prabhupada was very much against the scientists.
Yes, he was
the empiricists.
So against.
So what are their way of... Bhaktisiddhanta says it's best. We will really talk about a lot of this in the Patana, killing the Patana demon. But these three avenues, the way they work.
That means his demons, they will be in one of the three?
No. This we will be specifically looking at in relation to Patana. Specifically, we'll be looking at.
No, but I mean, that three avenues is how atheism is spread.
That
means.
Very much so. But we're looking at it, remember, we're looking at Kamsa as a principle. We're looking at the principle of, you know, the typical aggressive empiricist. How does such a person work? Not just Kamsa. We've got a lot of small-timers in this category now. In all fields, economy, so many things. So we're looking at this, not just specifically Krishna, Kamsa as a person, but we're looking at the principle behind it. Yeah.
Could you please just shortly, I can't understand the third one,
dictionary
translator.
Yeah. there were many, not many, but a couple of Sanskrit scholars who derided Prabhupada's translations because they were working from, their minds worked with dictionaries. They were materialists who knew Sanskrit. They had no vision through previous, they had no connection with Parampara, no faith in Acharyas, no concept of realization. So, you know, that kind of person is a real disturbance, because with Sanskrit in particular, you can make it say anything. You know, basically. It's such a subtle language. Mm-hmm. So they're very useful people for putting out, because basically what we're looking at here is how to capture usually innocent but ignorant people. They have hearts, they have a tendency to do good. Okay, so they need we need to work through religion. Mm-hmm. Okay, somebody's got to talk to them. And they've got to read something. So we make sure it's all kaitava. Then our purpose is served. Understand what I'm saying? It'll really come up when we discuss Patana. Very strongly. Okay, so we can understand from what we've heard about Kanta that he's a very nasty fellow. But we haven't heard about his activities. So what I'd like to do now is read a little bit from Garga Samhita. I'll get two of our devotees to read a little bit from Garga Samhita, so we get some idea of his strength. Why only Krishna could kill him. And of his conquests. Why he couldn't be just put in his place. Why he had to be killed. He was such a disturbance. He wasn't some small-time king working out of Mathura. He was actually a universal disturbance. So if maybe we'll hear about his strengths. Would you like to read? This is from Garga Samhita, chapter 6, I believe.
Yes.
Okay.
Sri Bahulaswa said, "Who was this very powerful demon, Kamsa? O great sage, please describe his births and activities." Sri Narad said, "At the time of churning the milk ocean, a great demon named Kalanemi fought with Lord Vishnu and was violently killed by him. When Shukracharya revived Kalanemi by means of Sanjeevani, the demon yearned to fight with Lord Vishnu again. On Mount Mandara, he performed severe austerities, drinking durva grass juice and worshipping Lord Brahma. When 100 celestial years had passed, all that remained of Kalanemi was his bones inside an ant hill. Brahma then appeared and said to him, 'Ask for a benediction.' And so Kalanemi replied, 'May my death not come from the hands of any of the demigods who have Lord Vishnu as their root.' Sri Brahma said, 'O demon, the benediction you request is difficult to attain. Still, I will grant it.' From the womb of Ugrasen's wife, Kalanemi attained another demoniac birth. Even in his childhood, he would regularly fight with great wrestlers, desiring to conquer all directions. Jarasandh, the king of Magad, set up camp at different places by the side of Yamuna. At that time, the elephant, Kuvalyapida, who was as strong as thousands of ordinary elephants, became angry, broke his chains, and ran from the Jarasandh's camp. Kuvalyapida went to the mountains and entered the wrestling arena where Kamsa was fighting. When the other wrestlers fled, the elephant approached Kamsa, who then grabbed him by the trunk and threw him to the ground. When Kuvalyapida attacked once more, Kamsa threw him into the midst of Jarasandh's army, some 80 miles away. Becoming very pleased by seeing this amazing display of strength, the king of Magad gave his two daughters, Asti and Prapti, as well as the elephant to Kamsa. As dowry, Jarasandh gave 100 million horses, 100,000 elephants, 300,000 chariots and 10,000 maidservants. Thereafter, being very proud of the strength of his arms and eager to fight, Kamsa went all alone to Mahishmati. Chanur, Mushtik, Kut, Shal and Toshal were the sons of the king of Mahishmati, and they were wrestlers who were very eager to defeat their opponents. Kamsa calmly said to them, "Let us fight. If you win, I will become your servant. If I win, I will keep you all as my servants." All these great wrestlers agreed. When Chanachur rushed at him, Kamsa made a great sound and threw him to the ground. When Mushtik rushed at him with voracious punches, with one punch, Kamsa knocked him to the ground. When Kut rushed at him, Kamsa knocked him to the ground, grabbed his feet, and violently threw him into the sky. When Shal, waving his arms, rushed at him, Kamsa caught him by the arm, pulled him down, and dragged him about. Next, Kamsa grabbed Toshal, knocked him to the ground, and by the power of his arms, threw him a distance of 80 miles. In this way, Kamsa made all of the wrestlers his servants, and on my advice, went with them to Mount Pravarshan. After challenging him, Kamsa fought with the gorilla Duivit for 20 days without becoming tired. Duivit then uprooted a mountain and threw it on Kamsa's head. Kamsa also grabbed a mountain and threw it on Duivit.
Duivit, you're talking about, yeah?
Yes.
Duivit, okay.
Duivit punched Kamsa and then jumped into the sky. Kamsa chased him and threw him to the ground so that he fell unconscious. Dispirited, weakened, and his bones broken, Duivit also became Kamsa's servant. Next, Kamsa went to Rashyamukh forest, where there was a great demon named Keshi, who had the form of a horse, whose whining was like thunder. By punching him again and again, Kamsa subdued the horse demon. Mounting it, the powerful Kamsa rode to Mount Mahindra. Kamsa uprooted the mountain, held it high, and then set it again in its place. Indeed, he repeated this 100 times. Thereafter, when he saw Lord Parshuram, who was as effulgent as the sun at the time of dissolution, and whose eyes had become red with anger, Kamsa bowed his head before him, circumambulated him, and then fell at his feet. Becoming pacified by this, Parshuram, his eyes appearing very fierce, said to Kamsa, O worm, O baby crab, you are as insignificant as a mosquito. Today I will kill you because you are a wicked kshatriya who is falsely proud of his strength. This great bow by my side weighs 100,000 bharas. Lord Vishnu had given this bow to Lord Shiva so that he could defeat Tripura, so that I could kill the kshatriyas. I received this bow from Lord Shiva. If you can string this bow, I will not punish you. But if you are unable to do so, I will destroy your strength. The demon Kamsa picked up the bow, which had been made from 7 palm trees. As Parshuram looked on, Kamsa easily strung it. Indeed, he drew the bowstring back to his ear 100 times and released it, making a thunderous sound that reverberated throughout the universe. It made the elephants that support the directions tremble and caused many stars to fall to the earth. After putting the bow down and bowing again and again to Lord Parshuram, Kamsa said, "O Lord, I am not a kshatriya. I am a demon and I am your servant. Indeed, I am the servant of your servant. O Supreme Person, please protect me." Lord Parshuram was pleased with Kamsa and gave him the bow. Sri Parshuram said, "Whoever breaks this bow of Lord Vishnu will kill you." Kamsa bowed down before Parshuram, but he had become very proud, thinking, "No king can fight with me. They only bring me gifts." Thereafter, on the seashore, Kamsa saw a demon named Agasur, who had a serpent's body and was licking his tongue and hissing. When the serpent came and bit him, the fearless and very powerful demon, King Kamsa, jumped on it and began squeezing its neck. In the east, a great bull demon named Arishta fought with Kamsa, just as one elephant fights another elephant. With its horns, Arishta uprooted a mountain and threw it at Kamsa's head. Kamsa then took a mountain and threw it at Arishta's head. Then, with a single punch, the great demon Kamsa made Arishta fall unconscious. After this victory, Kamsa went towards the north. There, being very eager to fight, Kamsa said to Narakasur, Prayag Jyotisha's very powerful ruler, who was a son of the goddess of the earth, O king of the demons, please give me battle. If you are victorious, I will become your servant. If I am victorious, I will make you my servant. First, a very powerful demon named Pralambasur fought with Kamsa. They fought as one lion fights with another lion. Finally, Kamsa wrestled him to the ground and then threw him into the city of Prayagjyotsa. Next, a demon named Dhenuka came and grabbed Kamsa. With fearsome strength, Kamsa angrily threw Dhenuka 800 miles, jumped on him, and crushed him with many hard punches. On Narakasura's order, a demon named Trinavad pulled Kamsa into the sky and fought with him 800,000 miles above the earth in outer space. With limitless strength, Kamsa dragged the demon from outer space to the earth and made him vomit blood. Next, when a powerful demon in the form of a duck named Bakasur tried to swallow him, Kamsa made it fall with a single punch that was as hard as a thunderbolt. Lifting himself up, the white-winged demon made a sound like thunder and angrily swallowed Kamsa with its sharp beak. When he was swallowed, Kamsa became angry so that his body became hard like a thunderbolt. Its throat breaking, the great duck Bakasur spat Kamsa out at once. Kamsa grabbed Bakasur and threw him to the ground. As they continued to fight, Kamsa grabbed him with both hands, whirled him around and dragged him here and there. Then Bakasur's sister, Putna, came and wanted to fight. Kamsa laughed and said, Hear my words, O Putna. I will never fight with a woman. Bakasur had become my brother, and so you should be my sister. Seeing that Kamsa had apparently unlimited strength, Narakasur accepted defeat. He made friendship with Kamsa, in which they formed an alliance against the demigods.
So we can understand from this that Kamsa not only ordered them to go into Vrindavan, he didn't only order them, he was actually, they became his servants.
Mm-hmm.
He subjugated them.
Yes.
And they were actually his servants. In that sense, he ordered them to go. So they're, you know, very powerful, extremely powerful person. So now we're going to hear again from God. Yeah.
But they were his servants, but also they were into it as well.
Oh, for sure. Definitely they were into it. In fact, some of them suggested that they go. But the point I'm making is that it's not that he politely asked them, could you do us a favor and go and kill Krishna in Vrindavan?
Like Putana and Pralamba, so they went on their own idea, no? They said to Kamsa, let me go on.
Well, the interesting thing that we're going to find in looking at Naimittika Leela, these occasional Leelas, is that you will get different understandings of what's happening in the Leela. And this raises a very important point that we have to be aware. I think it's in Bhagavad Gita 4.6 purport. Prabhupada compares Krishna's appearance and disappearance to the rising and setting of the sun. And that actually the sun never sets. Our perception tells us it does. It never rises. We think it does. In the same way, Krishna's roadshow is going on throughout material existence. So the acharyas, they're going to tell us, or Gargamuni, they're going to tell us different. Krishna's not going to get, he's going to do things differently. He's going to do different things. He's going to do things differently. Like one acharya will tell you that Balaram went alone into the forest to fight Janakasura. Prabhupada tells us they all went together. So, you know, we don't, it's a very important point that we don't think this is right, that is wrong, but rather Krishna has unlimited, he's performing these pastimes unlimitedly out of his unlimited compassion for us. And he's going to do it different ways. Because as Krishna Das Kaviraj tells us, his only business is sense gratification. He's an enjoyer. He's not going to do the same thing day after day like a factory worker. He's just not going to do it. So, you know, this is a good point to keep in mind. According to one acharya, it may be that Patana suggested I go. Another acharya will say that Krishna ordered her. Or his advisors ordered her. So many things will be said. But it's very interesting to see the different perspectives. And it's actually relishable. Is that okay?
Actually, I have a question.
Sure.
When we talk about Kansa's strength, and we also think about what he represents.
Yeah.
So within us, you know, that anartha is that strong?
You see, that anartha, we're talking about the demons killed in Vrindavan. These are the anarthas in the heart. Yeah. Because, it's very interesting, Bhaktivinoda Thakura is such an incredible psychologist. But the thing is that we want to make our hearts Vrindavan. We don't want to make our hearts Dwarka or Mathura. So we're looking at, he's done an analysis of the demons that were killed in Vrindavan. And he does in Krishna Samhita talk about different kinds of anartas that are related to Dwarka and to Mathura. But we're not going to deal with those because we're not really interested in those places. So we don't have to worry about that. We just have to. I'm just wanting to give a background of the one behind the scenes. He's in Mathura, but he's sending all these demons into Vrindavan. We just want to have a look at this guy.
Yeah.
You know, if we know what we're dealing with, it's a lot easier to deal with it, right?
Yeah, that's.
So it was in that mood that I was thinking. Would you like to read something about his conquest? You haven't listened to this. This is amazing. You know, this gives us a very clear understanding of the fact that, you know, we are 1/10,000th the tip of a hair. You know, how are we going to deal with these people that take on all these forms? You know, how are we going to deal with that? We have to depend on Krishna. We have no choice. That's why Saranagati is the only real religion. We can't lift ourselves up. We can't fight the demons. You know, we're dependent on Krishna. Let's have a hear at this. This is really something. You thought the last part was interesting. Yeah, listen to this.
Srinarada said, accompanied by Pralamba and the other demons he had defeated, Kansa went to the city of Shambhar and challenged him. Although he was very powerful, Shambhar did not want to fight. Instead, he made friends with Kansa and all his powerful allies. A very powerful demon named Vyoma slept on the summit of Mount Trikuta. When Kansa awakened him with a kick, his eyes became red with rage. He stood up and attacked Kansa with hard punches, and thereafter a terrible battle of fists took place. Kansa's punches soon weakened Vyoma, however, and made him dizzy. In this way, Kansa made Vyoma his servant. Kansa then came to me and bowed down to offer respects. He said, "O sage, I yearn to fight. Where should I go?" I told him,
"Narad,
go to the very powerful demon Banasur." Then thus sent by me, Kansa, who was filled with pride in the strength of his arms and was looking for a fight, went to the city named Shonita. When he heard Kansa's challenge, the mighty Banasur became very angry. He kicked the ground and roared like thunder. Indeed, that kick pushed his leg through the ground up to his knee and his foot reached the Patal Loka. At this, Banasur said, "Please pull me up as I was." Using both hands, the proud and powerful Kansa pulled Banasur up, and as an elephant pulls up a lotus flower. By this pulling, the 7 lower planetary systems were devastated. Many great mountains fell, and the sturdy elephants holding their directions stumbled. Seeing that Banasur was eager to fight, Lord Shiva arrived, greeted everyone, and then said to Bali Maharaja's son, Banasur, "Except for Lord Krishna, no one can defeat Kansa." Lord Parshuram gave him that benediction and also gave him Lord Vishnu's bow. In this way, Lord Shiva made peace between Kansa and Banasur so that they became great friends. After hearing of a great demon named Vatsasur, who appeared in the form of a calf and who lived in the west, King Kansa fought with him. Kansa grabbed the calf demon Vatsasur by the tail and threw him to the ground, bringing him under his control. Kansa next went to the countries of the barbarian Malechas. Having heard about Kansa from me, the red-bearded Kalyavan picked up a club and went to fight with him. Kansa picked up his club, which weighed 100,000 bharas, and threw it at the barbarian king while roaring like a lion. Thereafter, Kansa and Kalyavan fought a terrible duel. Indeed, sparks flew from their clubs when they collided, so that finally they were ground into powder. Kansa then grabbed Kalyavan, threw him to the ground, jumped on him, and beat him so violently that he almost died. When Kalyavan's army showered him with arrows, the powerful King Kansa knocked him to the ground with his club. Then, as he proceeded to knock down the enemy's elephants, horses, chariots, and soldiers with his club, Kansa roared like thunder. Finally, the barbarians fled the battlefield. Respecting the code of chivalry, Kansa did not attack the frightened, fleeing barbarians. Lifting his feet and knees, his thighs like pillars, his waist slender, his chest like a great door, his shoulders broad, his arms massive, his eyes like blossoming lotus flowers, his hair long, his complexion ruddy, his garments black, wearing a helmet, earrings, necklace, and a lotus garland, effulgent as the sun at the time of cosmic dissolution, wielding a sword, shield, quiver of arrows, and club, proud Kansa went to Amravati to conquer the demigods. Aided by Chanur, Moshtik, Arishta, Shal, Toshal, Keshi, Pralamba, Baka, Durvira, Trinavarta, Agha, Kuta, Narakasur, Bana, Shambar, Vyoma, Dhenuka, and Vatsa, Kansa besieged the city of Amravati. Seeing that the demon headed by Kansa had come to attack, Indra, the sovereign king of the demigods, became angry and, accompanied by a great host of demigods, went to fight them. A terrible tumultuous battle was fought, making the hair stand up on the end of all who witnessed it. When showers of arrows and other divine weapons created a blinding darkness, King Indra, riding on a chariot, released his thunderbolt at Kansa. With his club, the great demon Kansa struck the thunderbolt, making it fall broken upon the battlefield. Next, Indra picked up a sword and angrily struck Kansa on the head, making a terrible sound. Kansa was not hurt, however, like an elephant struck by a flower garland. He then picked up a great and heavy club made of 8 metals, weighing 100,000 bharas, and threw it at Indra. Seeing it coming, Indra easily caught it. Indra, the killer of Namuchi, threw the club back at Kansa. In this way, Indra, while cutting his enemies to pieces, his chariot driven by Mathali entered the battlefield. Taking an iron club, Kansa struck Indra on the shoulder, making him momentarily unconscious. At that time, the Maruts covered Kansa with a shower of arrows so that it appeared like a monsoon cloud covering the sun. Making a great sound as he utilized many bows with his 1,000 arms, the powerful warrior Banasur drove the Maruts back with his onslaught of arrows. Surrounding Banasur as a host of elephants might surround a mountain, the Vasus, Rudras, Adityas, Ribhus, and Suras attacked the demon with great variety of weapons. Then, assisted by Pralamba and the other demons, Narakasur let out a terrible roar that made the demigods fall unconscious on the battlefield. Quickly getting up, his eyes red with rage, Indra mounted his furious 4-tusked elephant Airavat, provoked by the striking of a goat, trumpeting with its trunk, crushing its enemies under its feet, and made it charge at Kansa. With a hard punch, Kansa struck the great elephant, and with a second punch he struck Indra. As a result, Indra fell far down and the elephant was wounded and also fell to its knees. Again standing up, the king of elephants attacked Kansa with its tusk, picking him up with his trunk and threw him at a distance of 800,000 miles. Kansa's body was as hard as a thunderbolt, so when he fell, he was only a little upset within his heart. Being very angry and his lips trembling, he returned to the battlefield. Kansa grabbed Iravat, threw him onto the ground, strangled its trunk and broke its tusk into pieces. While knocking over many great heroes, the elephant Iravat fled the battleground and went back to the capital of the demigods. Taking the bow of Lord Vishnu and stringing it, and with a flood of arrows accompanied by the twanging of the bow, the demon Kansa made the demigods flee. As Kansa continued to attack and kill them, the dispirited demigods fled in all directions. Some, their helmets lost, screamed in terror. Some, dropping their weapons and armor, humbly surrendered with folded hands. Others, very troubled, had lost all desire to stand before King Kansa. Seeing how the demigods had fled, Kansa took Indra's throne and parasol and returned with all the demons to his capital at Mathura.
Quite a character, isn't it?